This is Eat Out In. Eating out in a restaurant is one of life's pleasures, isn't it? Someone else slaving over a hot stove, linen tablecloths, dishes gliding to your table, your wine glass topped up by charming waitstaff. But what we see as diners can be very different to what is going on behind the kitchen doors. Legendary chef, the late Anthony Bourdain, lifted the lid on some of the dodgy practices, encouraging us not to order seafood on a Monday, for instance. Well, an Australian hospitality worker has now written a tell-all book about the sometimes dysfunctional world of Australian restaurants. Jess Ho's memoir with Bite is called Raised by Wolves, and Jess is with me now. Jess, great to have you on Nightlife.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Now, Jess, you don't paint a very flattering picture of Australia's hospitality industry. How did you find yourself caught up in it in the first place?
I fell into it out of vague interest, a bit of necessity, and then it became an all-encompassing obsession. And I think that's how everyone falls into it, really.
Yeah, because the way most people go through hospitality, this certainly happened with me when I was studying in university. It was a easy job that could fit around my university hours, even though I had none of the skills required to be a waitress, and I was pretty hopeless at it. So for you, was it mainly a way just to make ends meet and have a job between study and other things?
It was. I also left home when I was in high school, so it was a way for me to just make money and survive while I was doing that. And because I have a pretty addictive personality, I'm also very competitive. Like, falling into hospitality, it wasn't just I'm going to carry plates on the weekend or after school for fun and earn some money so I can buy something after school. It was, oh, now I have to be the best at this.
You said you moved out of home when you were still at high school, and that is quite a challenging thing to do. Can you tell us a little bit about what your home life was like that forced you to do that?
Well, you know, when you move out during high school, it's not because you're having a row with your parents, it's because it is unlivable. And, you know, in a lot of situations, especially with migrant families, there is a lot of pressure and there's a lot of generational trauma that causes your parents to not understand how to raise a person. And, as you know, they're dealing with their own trauma by projecting it onto you. And so the safest thing for everyone involved was if I left.
Yeah. And you talk a lot about, the challenges of being a child from another culture and fitting into Australia and that trauma you mentioned that your parents have to deal with as well. There's a lot of trauma that immigrants and migrants go through. And just because Australia, most of us come from immigrant backgrounds, there is this sort of unspoken acceptance that this is just what everyone goes through when you're a migrant. But we don't talk about it much, do we?
No, not really. I think in the last few years, and like I'm a child of the internet. I love the internet. There was this Facebook group that started a few years ago called Subtle Asian Traits. And I think that's the first time I really saw people talk about all this trauma. And they all had the same inappropriate humor that I had around it. And obviously went viral. It spawned different ones from people from different backgrounds. And it's very comforting. And I'm pretty sure they're turning it into a Netflix series now.
Mm. So things weren't very good at home, which forced you to move out when you were a teenager. And hospitality was a way that you earned some money. So give me a sense of what the hospitality culture was like in Melbourne when you first started working in restaurants.
Oh, okay, so I'm going to out myself for how old I am. So it was pre-GFC and people had expense accounts. I guess everyone was very excited. Twitter wasn't a thing. No one had Instagram. Social media was like, what is this? Why am I getting sent an invite what is the Facebook? So it was really exciting. The world was a lot smaller and I think everyone was striving for excellence. And also people weren't exposed to kind of international levels of excellence and at the same time toxicity. There was a lot less ego and a lot more excitement, but it was still a very hard job, late nights, hard partying, reckless decisions, and, you know, I guess if you can turn up and do your job, even if you're a little bit slow, it's still considered a good day.
You do talk about the culture of the long hours and the heavy drinking particularly. I mean, I know in the media industry it's well known for its you know, addictive elements and the drug and the alcohol use, but hospitality is quite similar in that way.
Oh, very. It's quite eye-opening to... I have a lot of friends who come from country towns and they're like, you know what, I want to level up my professionalism in hospitality. And they're like, oh my goodness, you guys, like, we drink, but you guys drink and so openly do drugs and everyone's always on something, got something, working while recovering from something. And I think it's really shocking if you don't come up in it, and it becomes so normalized that you don't realize that you're all very, very damaged.
Yeah, I'm speaking to Jess Ho about her new memoir, Raised by Wolves, which lifts a lid on what life was really like in the hospitality industry in the early 2000s. Jess, so you've got this environment where you're still a teenager, you're living on your own, you're in a hospitality environment that is pretty freewheeling with not a lot of, you know, parental or structure around your life. How were you coping at the time?
Oh, I think, to be very truthful, I wasn't. And you know when you're doing it and you're like, I'm making money and I'm surviving and I'm paying rent, I'm feeding myself-ish, you know, you can shout your friends rounds of drinks. You think you're doing well because your normal is kind of the people around you, you know, they're your measuring stick. And it's not until you meet someone who is quite healthy and quite balanced where you go, maybe I should reassess my life decisions.
And what about the environment in the restaurants, the owners and the bosses and the head chefs and the, you know, the people who are managing the floor? Were they giving you any sense that things were getting a bit of out of control for you?
Not for me. The scary thing is I probably wasn't the most drunken person. I always showed up to work on time. I never called in sick. And, you know, that's another toxic trait of the industry. Like the saying is, unless you're in hospital or dying, you better show up for work.
Mm.
And, you know, I remember times where the flu was ripping through every single person in the restaurant. And it got to the point where people were working while they had the flu because we were kind of expected to. And then a number of us all got hospitalized with pneumonia because it just went that far. But it's so normalized. Like, people don't pick up on it. If anything, people like in management positions get upset at you if you take care of yourself and you're like, you know what, I'm burnt out. I need a day off. I need to recover. I would like to reduce my shifts. I would like some home life balance. I would like to see my family. They kind of see that as a weakness.
Yeah. And of course, that would have changed a lot post the pandemic because you know, all the staff now do have to stay home if you're unwell. So it's probably changed the culture quite a bit in hospitality because of that. Was it interesting, Jess, that all of this was going on behind the scenes, but the front that you had to present to diners was quite different?
Oh, yeah. From my perspective, if the diners are having a great time and you're basically invisible, you're very good at your job. You know, if everything's seamless, and it could seem that way when you're running out of dishes in the back, there's someone in the alleyway prepping a dish because they've run out of a particular component, or a delivery's come late. Everyone's like sweating profusely underneath their clothes, but the diners are happy. And you're like, oh, that was a good service. You know, it always feels like, you know, the wheels are falling off the trolley.
It's amazing, isn't it, that you could be in the same environment and sitting there in this calm, quiet, seductive dining space and have no idea about what's going on behind the doors. I mean, that's changing now with a lot of fly-on-the-wall television shows that are exposing what life in kitchens are really like and how chefs and head chefs can be pretty abusive and how staff are being treated. But if you were living in and working in that environment before a lot of those shows that expose that behaviour.
Oh yeah, it was not good. You know, I know stories of chefs who I am acquainted with who used to keep chipped plates in the freezer, and if someone was underperforming, they'd write the name of the chef on one of the chipped plates, and they'd be like, this is you, and they'd smash the plate on the ground in front of them. And this wasn't even that long ago. But somehow that's normalized. People just kind of keep their head down and work harder.
Mm. There's a lot of, you know, difficult stories you've shared in the book, but what were some of the good experiences? I mean, the camaraderie between the staff and some of the workers, those friendships, seem very deep and genuine.
Oh, yeah. So when you do a service with someone, it's kind of like you don't really care where they come from, you know, what they've done in the past. You have all just gone through a very traumatic service together, and you've helped each other as a team. You haven't had to ask for it. You just know that you're all working towards the same goal. So you know that they've got your back and you've got their back, and there's this trust that you've developed without knowing them. And I think that's why all my friendships today are mostly with hospitality people, because we have that innate understanding.
Shared trauma.
Yeah. And unfortunately, that's why, you know, after work, we drink so hard. That and because, you know, your adrenaline is like through the roof. You can't just go home and go to bed. You need something to help you knock yourself out.
Mm. Of course, there was some beautiful food experience as well through all of that time. What coming from your culture and your background, you talk about the way Asian food is seen and sort of fetishized in a way in the industry.
Oh, totally. It's really strange, and there's this push-pull dynamic with Asian food where they're like, it should be cheap and accessible and I can get it anywhere, anytime at a very high quality. But to replicate it, it's almost like they do something without the cultural understanding of it and say, it's a better version of it. And I'm a white person who's made it, therefore I'm going to charge more for it because my labor is worth more than an immigrant's labor. And seeing that dynamic and the way that people interact with food and with the way they speak about it even today, I guess it's an ongoing battle for all of us.
And it's that generic label. It's changing now, but it was this sense of Asian food, which could, encapsulate, 50 different cuisines.
Oh, completely. It's kind of like, look at a map. Look at all the countries that are in Asia, but also all the different regions. You know, you travel, like, my background is Cantonese. I'm from Hong Kong. I could not tell you how many regional differences are there and are present, because I don't live there. I'm not that versed in it. And yet someone will open a restaurant and be like, it's Cantonese. It's modern Cantonese with a little bit of fusion.
Well, you eventually did move out of that day-to-day hospitality style trade and started to explore events and putting on wine events. How did you find that?
It was wild because it wasn't until I did that and I actually met a lot of winemakers en masse that I realized that, their jobs, especially if they're vignerons as well, is that they are very, very smart, scientific farmers. So when they're in the big city and they're on tour and they're not on the land, you know, working with soil, doing hard manual labor, they're like, let's party. Let's party even harder, the people in hospitality. It's spring break. And, you know, these people are amazing and fantastic, but I think I have a lot of liver damage because of them.
Oh, dear. Yes, it seems to be, the side effect of, I think, working with hospitality or food and wine, that drinking is part of that culture. You then, after doing that for a while, have now moved into food and wine writing for Time Out, and, of course, producing this memoir, Raised by Wolves. Have you found your niche now, Jess?
I don't know. I don't think so. I think the thing that I'm really passionate about is talking about the things that people don't see in media and day-to-day life, and speaking to underrepresented people and giving them the opportunity to speak for themselves as well. While I was working on Raised by Wolves, I also produced a podcast called Bad Taste. Mm-hmm. And it's about who we are through the foods we eat, told from a BIPOC perspective in an Australian landscape. And I got to meet and speak with so many incredible minds and people who are just being very brave about their food systems and, you know, being brave enough to talk about dispossession and charging what they're worth. And I am hoping that everyone in Australia will slowly move towards these very brave ideas in the future.
It's a difficult time now, isn't it, with rising inflation, rising cost of food. People are making different choices. They're not choosing because something is fresh or nutritious or grown with environment and sustainability issues necessarily. They're just looking for something that's cheap and affordable that they can afford in their grocery bill. Are you concerned that we're living through an era at the moment where people aren't really going to be thinking along those lines as much?
I think there's a flip side to that, in that the general mindset with what we see in like food prices are because of industrialized, commercialized food systems that aren't as sustainable, and they never have been, not for the food ecosystem, not, for everyone's wallet. Whereas if you look in smaller community-minded food systems, whether it's a community garden, a farmer's market, going back to the old days where, you know, you do the weekly shop and, yes, you do have to go to three different places to get everything you want, you realise that in a supermarket you're actually paying for the convenience, for everything to be there. And, you know, when you shop in these smaller systems and meet the people who are actually growing your food or rearing the meat, it's cheaper, better quality, and can sustain you longer, can last longer in the fridge. And it's all just about changing the way that you find information about your food.
Hmm. We often in this segment, Eat Out In, ask our chefs and cooks to share recipes with us. And while technically your book isn't a cookbook or recipe book, is there a dish, Jess, that you throw together really quickly when you don't have many ingredients in the fridge, or it's late at night, you don't have a lot of time? What's your go-to dish?
Oh, dear. I always have many, many carbs in my house. I either have, rice in the fridge, or I've got fresh noodles ready to go, or because I'm a sourdough obsessive, I've got sourdough. So my go-to post-service food has always been a toasty, a really, really dirty toasty with shameful amounts of dairy, whether it's inside or outside the actual toasty. I've always got stock on the go as well, so just like noodles with fish balls and an egg cracked into it. Can't go past that. And rice always gets turned into fried rice when it's been sitting in the fridge for 24 hours.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you're always prepared. It doesn't sound like you're on the hop at all if you've got a stock going. Terrific. Sounds delicious. Now I feel like a toastie. Yes, and you're right. When you put the cheese on the outside of the bread, when you toast it as well as the inside, you get that lovely burnt crispy sort of shell, and it's delicious. It's a great way to have a toasty. Jess, thank you. Thanks for chatting to us on Nightline. It's been really lovely to hear your story.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jess Ho, who's written a memoir called Raised by Wolves about her time in the restaurant industry, lifting the lid on some of the slightly unsavoury things that she experienced during her time.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.